This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Illinois State University has a significant number of undocumented students who say they live in a constant state of anxiety.
I try to walk to school very carefully every single time because even if you get into an accident, it's not your fault. The police can still pick you up. So it's like dangerous everywhere.
GLT's Judy Valente talks with an ISU senior about his fears for the future. GLT's Laura Kennedy delves into bad movies with GLT's Psych Geeks and finds out why we can't seem to get enough. And hear from the drummer of the Rebirth Brass Band headed to the Castle Theater Sunday night. John Norton has that interview. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's January 11th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. President Trump and congressional leaders are trying to work out a solution for the thousands of young people known as Dreamers who were brought to the U.S. as children by their undocumented parents. Their legal status became uncertain after Trump ended an Obama administration policy known as Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Illinois State University has a significant number of undocumented students, and tomorrow CAUSA, ISU's Committee to Assist Undocumented Student Achievement, will hold an all-day workshop to address the legal challenges and increased threat of deportation those students face. GLT's Judy Valente has more.
Illinois State doesn't keep official statistics on the number of undocumented students. There is no immigration status box that has to be checked for admission. But those who work with the immigrant student community estimate there are at least 100 enrolled at ISU. I spoke with one of those students, a 21-year-old senior who came to the U.S. at the age of 17. He asked that his name not be used for fear of being reported to ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. I spoke also with Professor Juliet Lind, interim director of the Latin American Studies Program. Lind says undocumented students face daily anxiety and often feel the university campus is one of the only safe havens they have.
Having a place where students can go, where they know that they can find somebody they can trust and get reliable advice. The gamut of concerns extends from the whole admissions process, how to pay for college, what financial aid students have access to. I recently heard the story of a student whose parents can't help her move to campus because she's concerned, they're concerned that should they be pulled over on the freeway or some such thing, they could run into problems in that sense. So that kind of problem just with residential life, there can be emotional issues, right, particularly in the current climate, threats of intimidation or concerns or just anxiety about the future.
You have brought with you a student who is undocumented. For obvious reasons, he has asked that we not use his name. Perhaps tell us a little bit about yourself, what year you're in, what you're majoring in.
Yeah, sure. I am a senior in college right now. This is my last semester. And I am a double major in Spanish and French education.
And how is it that you came to the U.S. undocumented? Did you come as a child? What was that process like?
Actually, my story is a little different. When my family came to the U.S., we actually had documents, but I ended up losing them due to several complications in immigration. And I think something very important to point out is that even when I still had a visa, it was so hard to live, at least in this state.
In what way?
Well, we are, for example, I was not allowed to get a driver's license, so I could never get a car. Most of the official paperwork that I needed for doctor's offices, I could not fill it out, because even having a permit to live here doesn't give you the rights that other people do. So I remember my mom took me to the doctor when I was in high school, and one single bill that would have been like $20 with insurance cost was like $500.
So you had to pay that $500
yes.
out of pocket.
And it things just got worse after that. When I got into college, there was no financial aid. No one would help an immigrant, no matter if you had status or not, if you don't have a social security number, you're not allowed to get any financial aid.
Is that still the situation now where undocumented students cannot get financial aid?
Yes, it's certainly complicated. But one thing that CAUSA, the Committee to Assist Undocumented Student Achievement, is looking to do is to locate and identify resources, scholarships, for example, that do not require citizenship status to attain and to generally assist students. But certainly lack of access to financial aid is an enormous issue, an enormous obstacle to higher education.
Well, I'd like to ask you, as a student, if you're more nervous this year than you were last year, the detentions have been stepped up, the number of people being picked up has stepped up.
Definitely. It's been getting worse, I would say gradually, because the president is taking so many actions, and I try to keep up with all of them. I read all the newspapers online, and they're so negative towards this community. Even people with documents are suffering. And I can give a couple of examples. Since I lost my status like a couple years ago, again, because of how complicated the immigration process is, basically in order to get a student visa to stay in college, you have to prove that you have at least $40,000 in your bank account, which I haven't met a middle class family who has that money just up the bat. So I, as a citizen from another country, could not get a status. And then these last couple years in college, it's like every single thing, like for example, I had to change places where I was living because I could no longer rent from my subleaser because he would not allow people without the documents. That was, he said, it was a policy that was happening all over the country. Every time I travel with my friends of the state, I have to be extremely careful because you never know who's going to be an ICE officer. Actually, I barely do anything. I try to walk to school very carefully every single time because even if you get into an accident, it's not your fault. The police can still pick you up. So like you can be a victim of a car accident or someone like try to hit you with a car. And you're the one who gets sent back. So it's like dangerous everywhere.
Dr. Lin, does this sound familiar to you? Do you hear similar sorts of worries from students?
Yes, absolutely. And I would say the additional concern of students or anybody with undocumented status concerned about going to the police if they have been victims of a crime or have knowledge about a crime or witnessed a crime. Anxiety, to say the least, about coming forward to the authorities if they or anybody they love is at risk.
I have friends who's they're citizens, but their parents, they have absolutely no status now. Because one of my friends, his mom, she used to be DACA.
Deferred Action for Childhood Immigrants.
And she lost it as soon as President Trump decided to put this little time clock on it for the Senate. She cannot go to the grocery store anymore or there are places in fear that she's going to get pulled over and the cops just going to ask for her papers. And if they don't see anything, then she could be deported right away in 48 hours.
What about your friends who are so-called dreamers who were brought here as children? What do you hear from them, given that their status is so uncertain now? The president basically has stopped that program, but Congress has not done anything to extend it yet.
It's awful because you've been in this country for so long, and you were here when you were so little. So everything you know is this culture, this place. And all of a sudden, just because you don't have a single paper or document, you're told you don't have any rights as everyone else who lives here. And then all your whole life is put into jeopardy because you can be deported right away. And then when you're sent back to a country with a culture that you don't know, a language that you might not even speak, with absolutely no resources at all. So obviously, and I have friends who are in this situation who are always so anxious. Every single time they walk, they look both ways. Every single time they see a cop, they try to take the other way. Not because they're doing something wrong, because they're in fear of something happening to them.
Dr. Lin, are most of the students that you come in contact with, have most of them been brought here as children?
I don't ask unless students come forward with that information to to me. But I would say, I mean, we can be talking about undocumented students. We can be talking about documented students, right? Students who have DACA at least until it expires, right? And that's all very much up in the air and uncertain. And then you have students with undocumented family members. So students who maybe were born in the United States and are citizens, but are deeply worried about their parents or about other family members or friends or members of their community.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Judy Valente. I'm talking with a 21-year-old undocumented student at Illinois State University and with Dr. Juliet Lind, who is the interim director of the Latin American Studies program at ISU. You want to hold a training on this whole issue. What are you hoping the takeaway will be?
We are hoping to both raise awareness among administrators, faculty, staff on campus, We are hoping to identify particular needs here at ISU and then to figure out a plan of action for moving forward so that we can figure out the kinds of support that our students need and that we're able to give them and move forward with a plan of action to institutionalize that support.
Last year, there was talk about whether or not ISU would become a so-called sanctuary campus. Where does that stand now?
We are not officially a sanctuary campus, but there is a lot of goodwill on campus and a lot of desire to be as welcoming as possible to take measures to support all of our students on campus.
Well, I'd like to ask our student, how are you treated by other students, especially if they understand or somehow surmise that you are undocumented?
In general, the whole atmosphere at ISU is really good. One of the most important things to realize is that immigrants were not a threat to society. And once they actually get to know each person, it's easier to see that all these myths and all these prejudices are just, they're not founded correctly. Like, I always hear people saying, like, undocumented people take away all the services from the government, all the special rights and things. In reality, we don't get any benefits. For you to apply for the most basic benefits from the government, you have to have papers. People don't get that. Like, we don't get Social Security. We don't get any kind of Medicaid or stuff like that. It's just you live whatever you can. You get a job wherever they pay under the table, and then you live from that.
Are you working now?
I am.
How does that work with your employer? Does your employer know you're undocumented? Is it sort of an under-the-table kind of thing? Or?
Well, I mean, as a single-income student who's trying to survive, I had to find a way. And then I found this establishment that was able to hire me, and the manager was okay with the situation. He told the owner, and they were okay with it. As long as I do hardworking and I stay honest, they will pay me, which is the only way that I found to survive, because no other place would hire you without a status.
What do you think about that, Dr. Lind? Is that fair to the students who really want to work and need to work to pay for their books and their tuition?
No, I don't think it's fair at all. I think that access to higher education is a civil rights issue, and that everybody deserves the opportunity to do so. Everybody deserves the opportunity to work.
What do you see for your future? I'd like to ask the student.
Well, it's complicated to answer because I honestly don't know at this point. I know I'll be graduating, and I know that ISU will not pose any obstacles for that, and I'm thankful for that. But in terms of what happens afterwards, I honestly don't know. Getting a job will not be easy.
Do you have any hope at all of obtaining some sort of legal status in the short term?
Well, when I lost my status a little bit ago, I was able to get into contact with the immigration project in town. And after months and months and months of going through every single immigration aspect of it, there's no way. The system is so, I would say, old and so not updated at this point that people...
Meaning?
There's no special cases. There's no updates on how to make the system more efficient. It's so either black or white. Either you have papers or you don't. And you get them this way or this way.
The 21-year-old undocumented student Judy Valente spoke with originally arrived in the U.S. on a visa that is no longer valid. Juliet Lind is the interim director of the Latin American Studies Program at Illinois State University. One of the speakers at tomorrow's workshop is Daniel Lopez, the vice president of student affairs at Northeastern Illinois University in Chicago. Northeastern has nearly 300 self-identified undocumented students. Lopez says the actual number is probably much higher. Northeastern has created a program to aid undocumented students it says can become a model for other schools like Illinois State. Lopez tells GLT's Judy Valente that Northeastern has a long tradition of accepting immigrant students.
Even before coming to Northeastern, I always knew that Northeastern was a place where people in the community or in the higher education field would send undocumented students to the university because they knew that the university was open to serving undocumented students. Northeastern was providing opportunities for undocumented students by charging in-state tuition for those students who had graduated from an Illinois high school.
What are some of the programs that you have at Northeastern that, one, you think are unique, and two, that can be modeled in other universities like Illinois State University?
Here at Northeastern, we are the first state institution that has funded a full-time position to serve as a director for undocumented student resources. We're one of the first state institutions to have that.
And what does that person do?
Well, their role is to assist undocumented students with navigating the university from admissions through enrollment and advising. So they work with them one-on-one to make sure that the students have the information that they need to be able to be successful. And more importantly, identify both institutional and external funding to help them pay for their education, because even though they pay in-state tuition, undocumented students in the state of Illinois are not eligible for state financial aid or federal financial aid.
What else does Northeastern do that you think is unique?
We also have developed a very comprehensive training program for faculty and staff to help them, help faculty and staff know how to serve undocumented students, from informing them about what are the challenges the students have to some basic information about what is an undocumented student, what they're eligible or not eligible for, and to be able to be more of a student-friendly institution for all of our students. We train them as allies for undocumented students and their families. And what it is, what they do is, once they're trained, then they're able to answer questions and provide resources for students without having them send students from department to department to answer questions about financial aid or admissions or scholarships.
Well, you'll be one of the keynote speakers at a day-long workshop on undocumented students here in Normal on Friday. What is your message to, for example, the educators that will be there from Illinois State and maybe even Illinois Wesleyan or the other colleges that are here?
Well, the number one message is that, first of all, we know we have undocumented students everywhere here in Illinois and throughout the country. They are at our institutions. They may not be in the same numbers that we have here at Northeastern, but I know that Illinois State has a number of undocumented students. And so one of my messages is to try to help them develop programs and support services to support those students. And not only doing that, what I want to help them do is develop processes or policies that are going to help, in this case, Illinois State, Wesleyan, whoever is there, figure out who are their undocumented students and how they can better serve them. Because at many institutions, students are still don't feel comfortable sharing their undocumented status, and because they don't feel comfortable, they don't ask the right questions, they don't talk to the right people, and they may be stopping out because they can't afford to be in school, and they're not making progress towards their degree because they are not fully utilizing the university resources because they just don't know.
I assume that a number of the students are so-called dreamers brought here as children. They've grown up in the U.S., in your case, in the Chicago area. How do you think the recent ruling by a California district judge saying that the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals policy has to remain in effect?
Well, I was really pleased to hear that we're moving in that direction. And I hope that we are able to renew the commitment that President Obama had for the Dreamers, because otherwise we're going to be seeing a lot of those students who are going to stop out or drop out permanently from our higher education institutions because they're not going to be able to stay in school, because one of the things that if DACA goes away, they're not going to be eligible to work to pay for their school. Hopefully we will be able to renew this DACA and provide some comprehensive immigration reform that we very much need.
Dr. Daniel Lopez is the Vice President of Student Affairs at Northeastern Illinois University. Thank you so much for talking with me.
You're welcome.
I'm Judy Valente.
The workshop on undocumented students is sponsored by ISU's Committee to Assist Undocumented Student Achievement, known as COUSA. It'll take place at the Marriott Conference Center in Uptown Normal. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Coming up, it's a conversation with drummer Keith Frazier of the Rebirth Brass Band. The group makes a stop at the Castle Theater in downtown Bloomington on Sunday. John Norton has that interview on the way during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The recently brutally low temperatures brought a host of problems to central Illinois, including one issue that gardeners need to address or risk losing plants. Patrick Murphy, host of GLT's Grow, has some advice for gardeners.
Winter weather can take its toll on our yards and gardens by causing a problem called heaving. I'm Laura Kennedy, and this is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert in the field. From the Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences, I'm looking at you, Patrick Murphy.
It's cold outside.
It's so cold outside, and that's the problem, Murph. It's causing problems in our yards. Tell us about heaving. What is that?
Well, heaving occurs after the soils are exposed to freezing temperatures and there's lots of water around. So it could be from a quick change in temperature. It could be from a freeze and thaw cycle. It usually happens late winter because weather gets kind of volatile in late winter, and you got some spring conditions always kind of sneaking around.
So we're really, really cold right now.
Right.
And this weekend we may warm up into the 40s, and then we're going to get really cold again because
yes.
It's January. So that's when we could see heaving occur.
That could happen. Or, you know, yesterday right outside the Science and Lab building on College Avenue, there was a water main break.
I saw that.
Well, that will have some negative impacts on the curbing, and there's not a lot of plantings around there that would be affected by it. But what happens is there is pressure created from this freeze and thaw, and it's very strong. It'll crack a safe open. It lifts soils, plants, materials, and other objects out of the ground. It's so powerful.
Is it like boom, it does it, or is it slow?
It's a slow creep. It's inevitable creep, you know.
Creeps are inevitable.
I've heard. I think it's fascinating because, you know, we can talk more about heaving, but I've been involved in the hobby of looking for arrowheads most of my life.
Uh-huh.
And I know that early in the spring, I'm going to find some because winter has forced them up out of the ground.
The ground gives them up.
That ground gives them up. That's right. So what happens also is that soils below what has heaved become compacted.
Oh.
Because, you know, things get lifted up, there's nothing to stop them but gravity. Well, there's lots of soil underneath of the heaving, so that layer that doesn't freeze and thaw, it gets smashed. So that's all compacted, and that's sometimes a problem in the garden.
What's the long-term impact of that being compacted like that?
It could add to, like, sinkage or spots in one's yard or garden that collect water, and then the cycle is magnified.
Yeah,
that's right. So heaving affects trees, shrubs, bulbs, tree stakes, edging of all kinds in the landscape, plastic, brick, properly installed, improperly installed, it can affect all of them.
Really?
And like I mentioned, even arrowheads. So heaving exposes new plantings to extreme cold temperatures. You know, so if you have a late season tree that you planted and you didn't mulch it, for example, and the conditions were right, the heaving will lift that plant in a manner that exposes the roots and the below ground parts to the freezing temperatures, and that's bad.
And once the roots are exposed and they're exposed to the freezing, you could lose something that you've just put in.
That's right. And the roots could be damaged, and even if it's just a portion of them, that's a big hit for a new planting. It's more common with new plantings than it is old ones because the plants that have been there for a while, their roots are kind of spread out like tentacles to hold them down to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But it can still affect your perennials in places like that.
What about about like sidewalks and fences and things like that? I mean, I've actually got my front sidewalk is kind of doing, it's kind of like overlapping sort of. Is that heaving?
That could be a tree root too that has lifted
it up. There's no tree there.
But so then, yeah, it is. And that's a great question to ask, Laura, because much like the plants, they succeed if they're installed at a proper depth. Mm-hmm. The same thing is true for footings. Footings are what go underneath of built objects in the landscape, like retaining walls and seat walls. If they are not properly footed at the right depth, and the area behind the wall that holds back the soil, if that's not set up correctly, the wall will fall away. It'll tilt towards the sidewalk. And sadly, you can see a lot of that around. So it's the proper depth that's really important there in the footings.
You're listening to GLT's Grow, our weekly gardening show for those who like to get their hands dirty. And today we're talking about heaving with our wonderful expert, Patrick Murphy. By the way, if you have a question for Murph, we'd like to hear from you. Go to WGLT.org/grow. Fill in the form and send it along to us. We'd really like to hear from you. So heaving, is there any way that we can halt it?
We can avoid the heaving when we do our plantings by making sure that we dress the top of the soil with 2 to 3 inches of organic mulch. So that's
shredded hardwoods. You're Mr. Mulch over here. You love that mulch.
There is magic in mulch.
Magic in mulch.
So you can add 2 to 3 inches of shredded hardwood or pine straw, whatever your preference and taste demands, mm-hmm. and that will give you a humongous advantage over that. So I can tell you that in my career, I've planted trees before at the late season, and weather didn't permit me to finish the mulching around the little earth saucer. Well, what do you think happened? Mm. Wow, that tree's crooked. Well, part of it heaved out of the ground, and I could have avoided that just by completely mulching the area over the planting site. Same is true if we were to prepare a bed of tulip bulbs. If you just leave them out there, bare soil for the squirrels and Mother Nature to ravage them, that's exactly what will happen. Now, that's what we can say about the heaving for planting. Mulch me. Please mulch me. Mm-hmm. And then when it comes to construction items in the landscape, brick paver landscapes, fence and deck posts oftentimes heave. We mentioned seat walls and retaining walls. All construction footings, including foundations of homes and structures, they heave when they are not constructed properly. So Western Springs, Illinois, I think, is an interesting town to mention because its name comes from the fact that it has a very high water table.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a suburb south of the city of Chicago. Well, I built a driveway for a client there once, and one crew started the job and another crew finished it. And the crew that finished it, they cut some corners, mm-hmm. and part of that driveway had to be rebuilt because it looked like lasagna in February. And it was really, it's funny now.
Guys.
Yeah, lasagna at the entrance, and then everything else was nice and flat. Well, the fellows that finished the job, yeah, they put some footings in there, but they were 3 or 4 inches deep instead of 6 inches to a foot.
So what do we have to do? Basically stand over people to make sure they're doing it right?
Well, I don't know if I can answer that, but I know this. There's a right way to do it all, and the information's out there. So if you're interested in doing it right and you don't have all the answers, don't be a joker and just make it up. Ask somebody that knows or go find the information out for yourself. Who would want to spend all that money on block and brick and everything to see it sagging and wagging and doing everything it's not supposed to do?
Mm-hmm.
It can all be prevented. And there's one other thing related to the frost heaving. Frost cracks in trees, they can appear at the same time and during the same weather that heaving would occur.
Yeah.
And so you could have an established tree, and where the little where the trunk meets the ground and it kind of flares out. It looks like an elephant's foot.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes there's little roots at the surface. They're kind of runners, and they have a lot of character. I love that look in the trees. But the conditions that bring on heaving can cause those roots to crack. It's unfortunate. A lot of times the tree will easily heal from it, just like a broken branch during a storm.
Yeah.
What you don't want to do is put stuff in it. Don't paint it. Don't put wound dressing on it. Don't do any of that stuff.
Don't cover it up with anything?
No. Mm. Mother Nature will take care of it.
Okay. Mother Nature always takes care of things. Sometimes Mother Nature is causing the problems, but then she also has solutions for us as well, doesn't she?
She has the master plan.
That's right. If only she'd let us take a glimpse every now and again. Well, next week on GLT's Grow, Murph has advice on how to perk up the bleak winter landscape. If you want to make things pretty, well, he's got some advice for you. And if you've got a gardening question or a problem that you'd like Murph to tackle, just go to our website. It's wglt.org/grow. You fill in that form, you send it along to us, and maybe Murph will pick your question to answer on the air. You got to submit those questions now. It's the middle of winter, but you know what? People still have questions. We still love to hear from you. You're probably thinking right now, making some plans for spring. We would love to hear from you. So submit those questions. Just go to our website and do that at wglt.org/grow.
The Grow Podcast is available for weekly downloading at iTunes and at wglt.org. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT and the Rebirth Brass Band. Frazier is the Rebirth Brass Band drummer. He says 35 years after the founding of the traditional New Orleans brass and drum band, members are now passing their experience to young, at-risk kids in the city. In advance of the band's appearance at the Castle Theater in Bloomington Sunday night, Frazier talked with GLT's John Norton about their motivation to help those kids and about how he got his start playing jazz in New Orleans.
Well, growing up in New Orleans, you're surrounded by musical events all the time, as well as musicians who perform those events. So you, as a kid, in other cities, you might get exposed to rock and roll, hip-hop, reggae, whatever the genre of music may be. But in New Orleans, you're exposed to live music. So you kind of grow up in it, and you want to be a part of it. And that's, a lot of kids get their start just by listening, and they just want to emulate what they see older guys do.
The band itself has absorbed so many different sounds. Obviously, you're a traditional New Orleans drum and brass band, but R&B, funk, hip-hop also are part of the mix now. Were you open to those new sounds from the beginning, or is that something that evolved over the years?
I think we were open to those sounds from the very beginning, because by us being so young, we were exposed to hip-hop, and so we tried to incorporate the hip-hop sounds into our music, while at the same time playing some traditional stuff, because older people prefer the traditional type of music that we play.
How was the hip-hop working with the traditional brass sound initially? Was it something you really had to work it out, or was it a pretty natural fit?
It was something that we had to really work out, because the older people, or the older guys who were doing New Orleans music, they thought we were, like, disrespecting the history and of the traditional music, but we were trying to tell them, like, we want to play something that can capture the attention of younger people like ourselves. So we had to kind of work it out and get them to get on board with what we were doing.
What got the older guys on board for you to incorporate hip-hop and rap into it?
I think the thing that really got them on the board is that they saw a commitment to the older music, to the traditional music. They say, okay, these guys are playing a lot of traditional songs. And they saw that we weren't trying to completely change everything. We were just trying to add something to it.
Is that the same for funk and R&B, working that in as well, or was that a little bit easier?
The R&B part was a little bit easier because a lot of bands before, such as the Olympia Brass Band or Dirty Dozen, they had already been playing like R&B type tunes in their repertoire of music. So that was a little easy to do. But the hip hop, by it being so new, that was something that they weren't readily available, able to accept.
There's a number of different brass bands in New Orleans. How do you distinguish yourself from the other bands in town?
Like I said, one thing that we do is we play a lot of traditional tunes. And we play them in a new way, but we always go back to the traditional tunes. We like to start out a set with a song called Lord, Lord. It's a very traditional song. And we try to let people know where the music comes from, and then we take them to where the music has gone to. Whereas a lot of other brass bands, they jump right into the brand new stuff. They don't really mess around with the traditional stuff as much.
Okay, all right. How much of the music that you play is improvised versus arranged?
We have a lot of arranged songs. We have a certain format that we play the songs in, but there's a lot of improvisation that happens. Like the song Do What You Want, the song that we created, we can play it a million different ways. We know the format of the song, but we can always add something to it, even while we're on stage performing.
Yeah, Phil! Everybody, somebody, everybody.
We're talking with drummer Keith Frazier. He's with the Rebirth Brass Band, going to be at the Castle Theater here real soon in Bloomington. I want to ask you about the Roots of Music nonprofit that you have. It's a program that helps at-risk young guys, and probably gals too, learn how to play music. What was the driving force to set up that program?
Well, that particular program was the brandchild of our drummer, snare drum player, Derek Tabb. He saw that there was a need for kids who were at risk between the age of 9 and 14 to be involved in instrumental music. And right after Hurricane Katrina, most of the music programs in schools were taken away. He was like, hey, man, I have a great idea. Let's start a citywide band. And so along with the help of Allison, a lady by the name of Allison, he got together with her and they got the business part of it set up. And they started this citywide marching band. And it has just taken off since right after Katrina.
When you say citywide marching band, what do you mean by that?
Kids come from all parts of the city. They're not from just one area of the city. He got together with a bus company to go pick kids up at school and bus them to a central location to teach them instrumental music.
That's an interesting idea. We had the director of our Performing Arts Center a couple of years ago. She has since passed, unfortunately. But she had a saying that when kids are creating, they're not destroying.
We see that all the time. We said we'd rather give them instruments than, you know, put instruments in their hand and have them have guns in their hands. So it's very important to, you know, find something constructive for kids to do between those ages, because they're very, you know, they're impressionable. You know, they do what they see other people do. So if they see that, if you're a 9-year-old, you see your friend playing in a marching band, and it's something that he just learned to pick up, more than likely you're going to want to do something like that too. And at the same time, it's constructive. So it's important that we have those type of programs in place.
Listening to GLT Sound Ideas, Keith Frazier, drummer of the Rebirth Brass Band, is our guest. You won a Grammy in 2011 for the album, The Rebirth of New Orleans.
That's correct.
And Best Regional Roots Album. Did that nomination come as sort of a surprise, or did you guys see that one coming?
It was a total surprise. We didn't know it was coming. The day we were nominated, we all had to go online and look at the nomination list because we couldn't believe that we were even nominated. We were like, we're nominated for a Grammy? So we were totally shocked, and when we actually won it, we were even more shocked to win it because it's really hard to win.
What did it mean to you to win that Grammy?
It meant that our peers recognized us for doing something that was noteworthy. And so we was like, okay, now these guys actually recognize guys who play this type of music as well. So it made us feel really good.
It's been 35 years, roughly, since the birth of the Rebirth Brass Band. What kind of differences have you seen, even from your fans, from some 30-some years ago to today? Are they wanting something different? Do they want the same thing as 30 years ago? What's the difference?
We've seen one of the differences that I've seen is that there's a lot more interest in instrumental music. You know, people think of guys playing instruments as something being geeky or something that's not hip or cool. Now that younger people are seeing that, you know, playing an instrument and being involved in that is actually cool. It's something that I was doing in high school or junior high school marching band, and these guys are taking it and brought it to another level. So that's one of the things we've seen.
Drummer Keith Frazier of the Rebirth Brass Band speaking with GLT's John Norton. The New Orleans group makes a stop at the Castle Theater in downtown Bloomington Sunday night. Listen to all of our music interviews on our new GLT Music podcast. Just search GLT Music on NPR One or your favorite music podcast app. It's Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from ISU Athletics, inviting fans to pack the arena Sunday at Redbird Arena as the women's basketball team faces off against Southern Illinois. Tip-off is at 2 p.m., and there is no charge for fans to attend. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. It's awards season in Hollywood, the time to celebrate the best the film world has to offer. As for the other end of the spectrum, bad movies, well, they're always in season. Look at the success of Mystery Science Theater 3000, a long-running comedy series that brought talking back to bad movies into the mainstream. Midnight movies, guilty pleasures, cult classics, whatever you call them, they're films so bad, they're good. But what drives our fascination? GLT's Laura Kennedy asked the psych geeks why celluloid cheese is so delicious.
Sunday evening at the Golden Globe Awards, actor James Franco won the award for Best Actor in a Musical or Comedy for the film The Disaster Artist, which is a fine bit of irony since Franco's film is critically acclaimed and based on the life of the man who created what many consider the worst film of all time, 2003's The Room.
Oh, hi, Mark.
Oh, hey, Johnny, what's up?
I have a problem with Lisa. She said that I hit her.
What? Well, did you?
No, it's not true. Don't even ask.
I used to know a girl. She had a dozen guys. One of them found out about it, beat her up so bad she ended up in a hospital on Guerrero Street.
What a story, Mark.
Yeah, you can say that again.
The Room sits atop a mighty heap of gloriously bad celluloid. Bad movies that we love. From Plan 9 from Outer Space to Reefer Madness, the sheer awfulness is irresistible. That's according to GLT's psych geeks, Eric Wesselman and Scott Jordan from Illinois State University's Department of Psychology. Wesselman says watching bad movies compels us to share the experience.
If I did watch it by myself, if I liked it, I felt compelled to share it with others, right? I don't just want to lend it to someone and say, here, tell me what you thought. It's no, I want to sit here and experience
their reaction to the terribleness.
Yes, as well as our reaction synergistically.
My first experience with what I would call riffing, the whole Mystery Science Theater phenomenon, happened in the spring of 1980.
My God, do you remember?
Oh, I do. It was very poignant. I had two or three groups of friends who hadn't played D&D together before. So we were bringing them together at my friend's house, and he had a huge sectional couch in his basement, and he had a VCR. And someone had rented Christopher Reeve's Superman. We put it on. And the next thing you know, within 10, 15, 20 minutes, we're riffing Superman.
Wait a minute, you're shouting back, but that's a good movie.
It's a fantastic movie to riff with a room of 18-year-old boys.
Okay.
But the point is, we had never experienced that before. Huh. We had never seen it modeled. You weren't allowed to go to the theater and riff the movie while you were watching it. We could only sit in my friend's basement and have that kind of weird fun we'd never had before because of the advent of the VCR. Once people could watch a movie as many times as they wanted to, movies became a different thing. Watching movies became a different thing. Like Eric said, he was a movie buff. I remember listening to Siskel and Ebert talk about the first time they realized they could watch The Godfather as many times as they wanted to, whenever they wanted to. And it's a completely different way of experiencing movies. So I think this ability to consume it over and over again gives rise to a culture of what I would call recursively consuming it, right? And that creates its own kind of culture. And then suddenly it becomes normalized. And now Eric's got his friends coming over every week to do this to movies, right? And it becomes a new form of social behavior.
So what is the appeal? What need or desire do these films fulfill in us watching bad movies?
I think one aspect is this bonding. It's the social nature of it. I mean, it's collective hilarity, to use a phrase that a film theorist, Andrew Tudor, mentioned, that we get together and we laugh. And we know from some psychological literature that laughing to jokes at whatever bonds us to those who are around us. Mm-hmm. So it also doesn't just forge connections, but to some degree, for some people, it becomes an identity issue. Mm-hmm. Like we are fans of lots of things. You know, I'm a fan of this team, this band, this genre, right? There are some people who own the fact and they relish in the fact that I love badness, right?
So
whatever that is.
There's no more guilty pleasure. Remember, we used to refer to bad movies as guilty pleasures, but now we don't have to feel guilty about it because a lot of people are sharing the desire for bad movies.
Yeah. It's only a guilty pleasure if you feel guilty for enjoying it. Not everybody does, right?
Yeah, I think the thing is it's not the badness of the movie that we're enjoying. It's the riffing on it with our friends that we're enjoying. When I first saw Mystery Science Theater,
there is a horror beyond yours. It It's in there.
It's Pauly Shore.
Locked behind that door.
Beside which Carol Merrill is standing.
I didn't make the connection that that was a socially emergent from what I had been doing in my basement with my friends in the 80s. And what Mystery Science Theater revealed to me is, we weren't the only ones that used our VCRs to do this. It must have been people all over. And then somebody said, hell, I'm going to make a movie out of this or a TV show out of this. And there's a convergence here. So we all feel like we're part of something that's increasingly big. So instead of just me and my friends in the basement, where we form an identity, we form an in-group about these movies, and all the other differences between us are ignored because we can focus on this, what's nicely, usually kind of disposable entertainment. No one gets hurt by us saying bad things about it. It's a safe way to, you know, maybe be a little mean.
Well, is there Schadenfreude attached to all of this?
Oh, yes.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah, right. It's an interesting point about Mystery Science Theater that I'd not really thought about until thinking about it, getting ready for this interview, is that even if it's just me watching Mystery Science Theater, which now that it's streaming on Netflix, my productivity has taken a huge hit.
You're just collecting data.
Watching what some scholars call parasocial relationships, right? So we can connect with fictional characters. We can connect with people who will never actually meet. So celebrities, we can feel connected to them. So I'm watching these people riff a film. I'm not in that space with them, but I still feel some of that bond as well. So even just watching MST3K by myself is para, in parentheses, a social experience.
There's sort of pseudo real-time riffing going on in podcasting. I contribute to a podcast called Sister Speak, and they will it's a group of women who will watch, for example, Walking Dead. They've been watching Walking Dead, and they'll analyze the show for an hour in their podcast, and then they'll read all the viewer email that comes in, and they start our listener email, and they start a whole conversation about the show. And Walking Dead has just gotten worse. And now they're hate watching.
Oh, no.
Well, some of them are, but they're sharing a culture of hate watching. It's just like riffing on a bad movie. And they're enjoying their company riffing on this bad. Now, they love Game of Thrones, so there's no, you know, hate watching of Game of Thrones. But it's just going to increasingly become real time. And then once it's part of how you're walking down the street, something will recurse on that. And it's not going away because people dig it, right? People do it together. It's not going to stop.
There isn't a lot of empirical data on this phenomenon, but we found a couple papers, and they've identified...
Good segue.
Oh, thank you. I didn't plan it.
It was organic. It wasn't in the script. Year.
Exactly. Okay. So there, you know, not everybody loves bad movies, right? There's not a whole lot of clear idea about what sort of internal, intrinsic personality factors, if you will, that would lead us to that. But at least for those people who identify as loving bad movies, they have some motivations from that, right? And so there are some people who are just like, no, I don't want to do this.
Like, right? It's a huge waste of time.
Exactly, right? And so they don't.
Yep.
Most people, at least in these data, who consume bad movies, they know they're bad. They know that this is transgressing a boundary of what we would call good or quality. They see it ironically, or they appreciate the glorious badness, I think is what you said. Or they have it as a guilty pleasure, and they haven't quite reconciled. They haven't just owned the fact that they love the glorious
badness.
Or
they're watching it so that they can talk about it at the water cooler tomorrow. I remember being in sixth grade, asking my mom and dad if I could stay up and watch the ABC's Tuesday night movie. I think it was called Terror at 30,000 Feet.
The sacrifice. The child. No! Please! Perhaps we could offer it this.
You mean like voodoo? You want to offer the doll instead of...
My God, that's hideous!
I wanted to watch it because I knew that my friends at school would be talking about it the next day. So they let me stay up, and then nobody talked about it, right? So some things have to do with keeping up socially, right? Particularly now, Netflix. I suspect a lot of people are pulled into watching these because they find themselves left out of conversations when they go out for dinner, when they're at lunch, when they're at work, because other people are going on and on about these shows that they're not watching. So
no, there's work in both sociology and cultural studies that talk about aspects of this, for lack of a better description, fan culture. I mean, this information, this the experiences, the I've seen this, I know the details about that. That's cred you want to be the one who's seen the bad movie, and not just the bad movie once, but you've seen it 20 times. You can recite it by heart. You know intricate details about what went wrong in the production.
What's your favorite bad movie, Scott?
Anything by Roland Emmerich. Independence Day, Godzilla, Independence Day Resurgence.
Wait a minute, the Godzilla with Matthew Broderick?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that sucks.
Absolutely loved that movie.
Okay, good.
Oh, no, I've watched that movie with my family at least 5 times.
Eric, what about your favorite bad?
So I managed to pin myself down to 2, The Evil Dead.
And, oh, right, with Bruce Campbell. Campbell, that's
and
it.
And we developed a love for Bruce Campbell from that, quotable lines. The other one is one that's tied into MST3K, but this is one that I can watch either with the riffing or without, and that's Santa versus the Martians.
Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. That has Pia Zadora in it.
Yes, yes, it does.
Yes, it's horrific.
Hooray for Santa Claus. See, I remember the song.
There you go.
It's wonderful. It's just wonderful.
And just horrible.
Yes. Glorious badness.
That's Eric Wesselman and Scott Jordan, GLT's Psych Geeks. They're both professors of psychology at Illinois State University. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Although the Normal Theater is known for running quality films, it's also succumbed to the jaw-dropping ineptitude of The Room, recently running it for eager audiences. In fact, across the country, the movie has regular monthly screenings for fans of bad movies. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website, WGLT.org, is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast and the individual stories and interviews today from Judy Valente, John Norton, and Laura Kennedy. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Our email address is news@WGLT.org. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 GLT, Bloomington Normal's public media.